This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, eat local, shop local, and invest local, a grassroots movement that values keeping your dollars swimming in small circles. Also, video games arrive with Hollywood-style campaigns to lure the aging gamer. And one thing getting smaller, the tiny house movement defies America's supersized tendencies. We'll also kick off Out of the Shadows, a series of reports on mental illness among kids in the Chicago area. But we begin with digital spying. Multiply 144 characters by the number of people using Twitter worldwide, and you have a dizzying pool of digital information. Now add other social media posts, webcams the world over, streaming information in real time, assorted other digital ingredients. It's just a lot of data. A research arm of the U.S. intelligence community is now looking to gather and translate that floating information to predict political upheavals, conflicts, epidemics, and other global unknowns. Sharon Weinberger is a Carnegie Fellow at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She wrote about the project for Nature magazine. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we hear political upheavals, I think Arab Spring, especially of Egypt, where protesters, as we know, organized and reported using the social media tools available to them. Is it safe for us to say that the Arab Spring caught U.S. intelligence by surprise?
You know, it depends who you ask. I think that was certainly the feeling from politicians saying that, we have this tremendous intelligence community, and here was all this tremendous amount of information coming in from social media, and why didn't you forecast this happening? Why didn't they forecast the downfall of Mubarak or the rest of the Arab Spring? So I think any time these sorts of large events happen, there's this idea that there's a failure of prediction and what can we do to make it better?
Hence this project. Unpack for us what it involves. Who's guiding it? What is it going to monitor?
Well, as you mentioned, it's IARPA, which is the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, which is sort of the far-out R&D arm of the intelligence community. They come up with these sort of new ideas, far-reaching ideas. And the basic idea is you have this, what we have in the modern world is tremendous, petabytes of data every day. You have social media like Twitter. You have edits on Wikipedia to current events. You have blogs. You have other microblogs. And then you have, information coming in from webcams that are everywhere, traffic cameras. Is there, and it's too much information for a person to analyze, are there ways that we can sort of trawl through all this data and come up with indicators, and hence the project's name, open source indicators, of a major event that's about to happen, like riot? I mean, to take something, happening today, like the riots at, the student riots at Penn State. And so that's the idea. Can you come up with computer algorithms, some sort of automated way of going through this data and predicting what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, or whatever the time period is?
And that methodology is already being used in other fields, a lot about consumer behavior, for example, outbreaks of diseases, which you write about, and also the financial sector, for example. Is there proven success in predicting any of these outbreaks or predicting the market?
It depends who you ask. So one of the common examples that's given is movies, box office successes. There are a lot of researchers now saying that we can, with, perhaps 90% accuracy, track social media to predict whether, whether the latest George Clooney movie is going to be a success or a flop. And they're claiming very, very high prediction rates with that. There's other examples, the way Amazon takes example of consumer buyer data. People are applying these models to the stock market. Disease outbreaks is another big one. There's Google collaborating with others on, whether people, Googling flu or cold can help predict outbreaks. And there's a lot of claimed successes, but there's also a lot of controversy over just how successful these models are. To give one example, researchers spar about the H1N1 virus, where you have, one group of researchers saying we were able to predict the outbreak long before governments were aware of it. But then you have other researchers saying, well, wait a minute. Your program picked up H1N1, but it also picked up 10 or 11 other threats. And so it's easy in retrospect to say we got it, but maybe you got one of 20. There really has to be a high degree of accuracy for this data for it to be useful to people to act on. And that's the challenge.
Especially if it's coming from citizen media. Of course, we in the journalism field have been looking at this a lot, whether or not it's a reliable source of information. Quantity of data, in other words, can overshadow quality.
It can. can, and it can be deceiving. You can think you're seeing things in the data that you don't see. It's not enough just to know that something's happening. You know, do you know well enough in advance? Do you know with a high degree of fidelity to do something about it? Another thing that people claim they can predict are things like, you know, the Occupy Wall Street protest or attacks, cyber attacks by Anonymous. But how good is your prediction? If it's 60%, 70%, and there are 8 other threats out there, what can someone do about it? It has to be, you know, sort of the term of art is actionable intelligence. You have to be able to do something with the information. And for that to happen, it really has to be pretty close to a crystal ball.
We're speaking with Sharon Weinberger about U.S. intelligence's experiment using Twitter and other digital data to forecast the next hotspots or, let's say, actionable bit of information. I'm thinking of just recently, New Hampshire was hit by a storm that dumped about 2 feet of snow in some areas. Now, this was on Halloween weekend, end of October. This was after a forecast predicting only a few inches. So it makes me wonder, what's to say these models will be any more or less reliable than, you know, something we get from a meteorologist?
Well, that's the ongoing joke. You know, we're as good as the weathermen. And then people say, well, wait a minute, the weathermen aren't that good. Well, you know, the truth is that weathermen are reasonably good. I mean, you can have forecasts of the weather, and they're useful. It's useful to have those forecasts, even if they aren't always correct. So that's the argument for it. You know, if we can be as good as the meteorologists, that's useful, even if it isn't 100%. I mean, if meteorology and weather weren't useful, people wouldn't look at it at all. It's not 100%. I don't even know if it's 90%, but it is useful. Weather is pretty complex, but it's pretty simple compared to the factors in sort of societal level events. I mean, human beings are complicated. The things that influence our behaviors, our voting patterns, are very, very complicated things, and you enter in so many variables. I mean, the old joke is, if these models were so great, you should be able to predict, you know, elections. You should be able to predict presidential elections, congressional elections, but the truth is we can't do that very well. So the more complicated things you look at and the higher degree of accuracy you want, it really gets very, very hard to do.
All right. We have just a minute left. But, I have to ask, what if totalitarian regimes were able to do the same thing? Could they stamp out unrest before it occurs?
Well, that's the argument. You know, in essence, for as supportive as the United States was for a lot of the Arab Spring and for, you know, criticizing governments that were trying to shut down sites like Twitter, trying to shut down social media, in essence, some of what this is about influencing behavior. It's not that the United States government wants to forbid any controls on social media. We want these things to help influence, do what enhances our foreign policy goals, our domestic goals. Yes, the idea is that this gives a tool for government, in this case the U.S. government, to help both predict and possibly influence events. And yes, if you can do it in one country, presumably you can do it in another.
Well, Sharon, I really want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon Weinberger, a Carnegie Fellow at Northwestern University's Middell School of Journalism. Her article about a U.S. spy agency using Twitter to forecast unrest appeared in Nature. And you'll find a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. So stay with us. After the break, the first part of a groundbreaking investigative series on mental illness and youth. Plus, video games take one more cue from Hollywood with big-budget advertising gimmicks. We'll have those stories for you when Word of Mouth returns from New Hampshire Public Radio in just a minute and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org. Welcome back. The news team at WBEZ in Chicago discovered some common threads while reporting on juvenile crime, school dropouts, and other obstacles facing Illinois youth. After producing those award-winning reports, the team set out to explore that link and came up with a series called Out of the Shadows, which looks at fractures in mental health care for kids. Today, we kick off the series, which will continue next week. We begin with a reporter shadowing a teacher at Lakeshore Hospital's psychiatric ward.
Katie Osgood is making her way down Lawrence Avenue. She's on her way to work. An ambulance passes, and she wonders if it's one of her students. Hers is not a typical classroom. There are no desks, some of the kids wear scrubs, and she's careful about what supplies she uses.
Count out my pencils, and then other things I just can't use, which, staples, paper clips. I mean, markers aren't dangerous, but you do have to kind of watch them.
Osgood's the only teacher at Chicago Lakeshore Hospital, a psychiatric facility that treats mentally ill patients, including kids. There are 40 beds for youth here, but her average class size ranges between 8 and 20 kids. She's a certified teacher, so kids get credit for half a day of class each day she teaches them. But because of privacy issues, she's not always privy to what they're learning at their regular schools.
I do always tell them, you know what, make sure you're okay first. If this is going to stress you out, we're not going to work on it today. You got to get well with you. A lot of kids will respond with, actually, no, I want to do this. Like, I feel like I can. Whereas, you know, if you're in a regular school, like, you kind of have to keep pushing them. I mean, today, like, a teacher's job is on the line if your kids don't get the grade.
The kids are between the ages of 4 and 17 and are from all over the city. But they have one thing in common. They are disoriented and away from their parents or guardians. They're admitted at all hours, even at 4 a.m.
Some of them are going through the hardest point in their lives. Like, it probably won't get worse than whatever it was that brought them here, whether it's a suicide attempt, whether it was a moment of rage where they got out of control, whatever it was that brought them here.
You won't hear Osgood in action during this story. I wasn't able to record her with students present because of privacy concerns. And it might not have represented an average day for her. There is no such thing. Things are always in flux. Her patients, their needs, their interests, their health, and capacity to learn. One thing is constant. Every morning, the kids participate in a group therapy session called community. The kids state why they're hospitalized. One kid says he kicked his sister's door down. Next to his name on a whiteboard up front, the counselor notes that anger is an issue he's struggling with. Under his goals, she writes, build up anger management skills.
A kid starts acting up or something, you can always point to the board. Oh, you're supposed to be following directions today, remember?
Osgood looks for signs that might help her teach the kids.
It's almost like cracking a code for all these kids, you know, figuring out what exactly is driving these behaviors, what is going on behind the scenes that's causing them. Because, you know, you might just look on and see, oh, the kid threw a chair. There could be 1,000 things. Someone could have called him a name in the morning, or maybe he didn't eat anything that day, or maybe, you know, he's going through being put into the foster care system and he's not going to see his family and he just found out. You know, you don't know what's happening.
All of the employees working with Osgood are trained to catch these clues, but Lakeshore is not without its problems. A study out earlier this year, commissioned by the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, claimed that children had been sexually abused because employees weren't keeping an eye on them. Hospital officials refuted those claims, and Osgood says she feels well supported.
One of my biggest things that I love about working at a place like Lakeshore is that I have a team of people with me. I always have a mental health counselor there in the room with me.
Every member on staff is trained to de-escalate situations, even the small ones that can escalate with these kids. Sometimes that can mean shutting down the entire ward if kids are arguing or getting too agitated. Osgood says maybe once or twice a week, a kid has to be restrained by staff. But she sees every act of discipline as a learning experience.
After you give a timeout to a child, you need to be able to process and say, well, why did you get the timeout? What can you do differently next time?
Having a doctor nearby means that Osgood can give input on how medications are working out.
Some of these mental health issues are brain-related. You know what? It's a chemical imbalance. And if you regulate that, then guess what? You see amazing results. We always remind the kids that medication alone is not going to, you know, you have to do your part. You have to use your coping skills.
Osgood gets to know some of the kids. Some have a hard time leaving even after they're medically cleared. Those are usually wards of the state who have no place to go. They often stay up to 6 months. Other students plunge back into the outside world.
A lot of times we're discharging these kids straight back into school, like the very next day. And half of the time, the teacher won't even know that the child has been hospitalized for psychiatric issues. You know, it's a protected health information, and, you know, if the family chooses not to share that, the teacher has no idea.
Osgood says she sees a lot of kids return to the hospital.
My objective is to kind of show these kids that they can do it. I want the kids to experience some success, especially the ones who've experienced a lot of school failure. You can rope them in a lot easier in terms of getting them engaged.
Osgood knows she's not teaching her kids to test or to pass a grade or to build on the lessons of a previous teacher. She's hoping to plant a kernel, something that might pop up later in life. Eileen Heikkinen-Weiss, WBEZ.
And stay tuned for more stories from WBEZ's Out of the Shadows next week on Word of Mouth. We've spoken on this program about video games as big-budget popular entertainment. There may be no better sign that video games have come of age than the over-the-top rollouts for new titles that, as independent producer John Lynch reports, now rival Hollywood blockbusters.
Fall is a time for warm apple cider, raking up leaves, and taking in the changing autumn foliage. Unless you're a gamer. For gamers, fall is a time of polishing their finest dragon-slaying helms, oiling their assault rifles, and hoping their significant other is turning a blind eye to the checking account. Where summer is the season of blockbuster movies, fall is the domain of big-budget AAA game titles, all of which are vying for your $60 with the most bombastic marketing hype possible. Electronic Arts, one of the largest publishers in the game industry, put out a trailer for the recently released Battlefield 3 that sounds nearly indistinguishable from every Hollywood war movie trailer ever made. Take a listen to what I mean.
Repeat, 18 hours ago, I get a call from Homeland Security saying there's a Marine in detention I need to talk to.
Gentlemen, as you know, we're dealing with insurgents crossing over from Iran.
You want us to believe that there's a PLR threat and Solomon's at the head?
You're the quick reaction force, gentlemen. I'm trusting you to handle this.
The nuke is still out there.
You can't just walk away from the threat.
Let's go find our Marines.
I said get down on the ground!
Rogue Nuclear Warheads, a trailer with a dark past, and scene after scene depicting soldiers fighting the good fight to dubstep music. This, ladies and gentlemen, is mainstream marketing. Not to be outdone, Activision Blizzard, the publisher that also puts out World of Warcraft, has resorted to one of the oldest marketing tricks in the book, the celebrity endorsement.
Fire up! Let's do this!
Okay, game on.
Watch and learn.
This ad for Modern Warfare 3 depicts a notably less portly Jonah Hill improving from lowly newbie status to grizzled veteran within the game.
Awesome.
The whole thing is set to AC/DC in a tongue-in-cheek nod to 80s training montages. My personal pick for the best marketing, however, goes to Bethesda Softworks' Skyrim, a sword and sorcery epic that takes place in the fantastical world of Tamriel, the video game equivalent of Middle-earth. It's got a sweeping orchestral score, no shortage of trolls, and a burly warrior with a horned helmet. It's handcrafted to appeal to your inner dragon-descended Viking.
But there's one they fear. In their tongue, he's Dovahkiin, Dragonborn.
As if employing the ever-grave voice of Max von Sydow, who played the grizzled priest in The Exorcist, wasn't enough, Skyrim planned its launch on November 11, 2011, or as Bethesda marketing materials ceaselessly refer to it, 11-11-11. Going one step further, the makers of the game promise any couple that has a child on 11-11-11 and named their child Dovahkiin in honor of the main character in the game gets the game for free, along with every other game the studio has ever made. It remains to be seen how many new parents will take them up on the offer. So when did video game marketing, which has historically been limited to trade magazines and industry website advertising, cross the threshold into the mainstream? The answer, unsurprisingly, is that it all has to do with money. With Xbox 360s and other game consoles becoming as ubiquitous as DVD players in homes, game publishers like Activision and EA have unprecedented access to consumers. And they're not just children. According to the Entertainment Software Association, the median age of your average gamer today is 37. And those middle-aged gamers are willing to spend their disposable income, as the ESA also reports that just over $25 billion were spent by consumers last year on games alone. Slowly but surely, the image of gamers as 10-year-olds begging their moms to buy them the latest Pokemon title is being replaced by an older audience. It's this group that big publishers are looking to when planning their blockbuster campaigns. Whether or not all this mainstream marketing is effective remains to be seen, but it's estimated that nearly 1.5 million gamers showed up to wait in line at the midnight launch of Modern Warfare 3 this week. And most of them were quite a bit older than 10. For Word of Mouth, this is John Lynch.
To see examples of extravagant campaigns from game publishers, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Coming up, the profits and challenges of locavesting, and a look inside the tiny house movement. Shouldn't take long, given the square footage. We'll be back with those stories after the world news from the BBC. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Small businesses are the backbone of the American economy, generating 80% of jobs and half of GDP. They're also suffering in the current economy with limited access to capital or support from big banks. A number of concerned individuals are stepping in to bump up capital for businesses in their own communities. It's called locavesting, also the title of a new book by financial journalist Amy Cortese. She addressed the annual meeting of the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund this week with some examples and challenges of the locavesting model, which intends not to occupy Wall Street, but to bypass it altogether. And Amy Cortese, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Give us the elevator pitch, the sort of summary of locavesting.
Sure. Well, I came up with a name to describe what I saw going across the country, where people were looking to find ways to invest once again in the local businesses that make up the fabric of our communities.
And you say, once again, your book does point out that this is how communities supported each other for millennia. So what happened?
Yeah, that was the natural way to invest. But over the years, we've sort of gotten away from that. One big reason is the federal securities laws that were put into place after the 1929 stock market crash. They were intended to protect investors, but the unintended consequence many decades later is that it prevents people from investing in a whole range of small private businesses that they really would like to invest in and that could really use the capital.
Regulations are still in place, however.
Yes, they are.
So there is some, we just got a note this morning, John Greenberg handed this to me, from New Hampshire Business Review, crowdfunding gets a big boost in Congress. What's going on congressionally that might change this?
Yeah, that's very exciting. President Obama actually proposed a crowdfunding exemption in his recent Jobs Act that was defeated. But nonetheless, he's still supporting something that would allow crowdfunding to happen on a small scale. And at the same time, you have a Republican-led House bill that just passed nearly unanimously, which was laying out very much the same thing. So rare bipartisan support. Now it needs to go to the Senate, and I'm hopeful that something would pass.
I'm reading here, under the bill, entrepreneurs would be allowed to raise up to $2 million from an unlimited number of investors without having to register their firm with the SEC. Any entrepreneur raising more than $1 million would have to provide audited financial statements to potential investors. So a big victory, I guess, for the locavesting kind of movement.
So far, yeah, it's not a done deal yet.
Yeah. Now, you write that the odds are stacked against small businesses. What, besides these regulations, lead you to this conclusion?
Well, in this country, there's a gross misallocation of capital. Small businesses create 2 out of every 3 jobs. They employ about half of the private sector workforce, and they are the force of innovation in this country, yet very little money flows to them. And that's only gotten worse since the financial crisis. Banks still aren't lending. Venture capital goes to a very rarefied few firms. And, who's got rich friends and family anymore? So a lot of small businesses are suffering, and a lot of entrepreneurs with good ideas can't get them off the ground. And our financial markets, the public markets, really cater to the very largest companies.
Yeah, I'm looking at figures that say about $30 trillion invested in securities each year, in mutual and pension funds and investments, mostly in stocks and bonds of corporations, many of them yielding profits to investors. Are there examples of profits for locavestors?
Yeah, small businesses can be very profitable.
And even some of the big ones. I think you write about Ben and Jerry's in the book.
Yes, yeah. I mean, every company starts small. But one thing about that $30 trillion number, a lot of our investments are made through 401ks, and you're presented with a menu of investments. Well, small businesses are never on that menu. It's always the big businesses. So therefore, that's the way we invest. There are a lot of different things going on within the narrow openings of the current securities laws where people are figuring out ways to invest in local private businesses.
But why should people with little money to invest take that kind of a risk? I mean, this is kind of an unproven market.
Yeah, writ large. But, you know, there are many, many examples of very successful small companies. I mean, Facebook was once small. Apple was once small. And since it's local, you know the company, you're investing in it maybe because you love the product. It's a restaurant. You love the food. You eat there all the time. It's about profit, but it's also about supporting a company that you love, you believe in, you want to see succeed, and that is part of your community and is enriching the community.
Financial journalist Amy Cortese is with us. She addressed the annual meeting of the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund this week and is with us for kind of a primer on locavesting, which is also the title of her new book. Well, you're reminding me of a very relevant story to us here in New Hampshire. River Run Books, which is a partner for the Writers on a New England Stage series from NHPR, looking for investing partners. It's, you know, a story of a very beloved local business that has run upon some hard times, as many bookstores have. But you have some examples in the book of this kind of thing exactly. I love the story of the bakery in Michigan.
Mm-hmm, yeah, everyone loves cops and donuts.
What's not to love?
That story is very emblematic of what's happening across the country with bookstores, restaurants, all sorts of beloved sort of mom-and-pop shops. But Cops and Donuts, yeah, it's in Clare, Michigan. There was a 111-year-old bakery that, you know, had served the town forever. It was about to go out of business. One of the cops heard this news and ran back to the precinct and persuaded his eight fellow cops, so the entire police force of Clare, Michigan, to buy the bakery, which they did. They renamed it Cops and Donuts, and they added funny merchandise like T-shirts that say, "Don't glaze me, bro," and DWI, donuts were involved. So they had a lot of fun with it, and it got a lot of media and really has been drawing ever since visitors from all over. And that success has spilled over to the rest of the town, and you're seeing some of the previously vacant storefronts now being filled again, and it's really helped the town prosper.
Well, of course, it sounds, you know, stories like this are great, and they are very much communal-based, but it does call for, locavesting does call for its own potential for abuse and need for regulation for the protection of investors. How are these communities managing that?
Yeah, well, it depends on what type of investment you're talking about. In the case of something like Cops and Donuts or the River Run Bookstore, I think what happens there is it's the business owner's reputation in the community that is really the collateral, mm-hmm. right? People are investing in these things because they want to. They love the bookstore. They love the bakery, whatever it is. I think that's more of a problem in some of the larger scale things like crowdfunding. So there are real concerns about the possibility of fraud, but, you know, technology can take care of a lot of that. Look at how eBay, you know, rates vendors. It's the community that rates vendors online. And, you know, if somebody doesn't send your book or the thing that you bought, you're going to get a bad review and people aren't going to go back to you. But the main thing I think that will mitigate risk is keeping it local. So if it's an on, you know, a physical community or a close online community, I think your chances of runaway fraud are much less.
Someone I know said that she invests in the vice funds, as she puts it, you know, tobacco, firearms, because it pays off. So is it just this number of, you know, the usual suspects drawn to do good in communities, you know, who never go to a big box store, you know, that kind of thing, who only eat local and buy local? Can this movement broaden out beyond those usual suspects?
I think it can, and I think it has to really play a meaningful role in changing our financial system. I mean, look at Occupy Wall Street. I think they're voicing a lot of frustration that a lot of people share that may not be out there in the streets, but, you know, people are pretty fed up with Wall Street and that fee-heavy, you know, that sort of extractive, predatory model of capitalism that they practice. This is about a more human-scale capitalism. I think it can promote more broadly based prosperity. And I do think it resonates quite widely. But what we need really are more mainstream ways to be able to invest this way.
Okay, any stock tips for us? For
River Run Bookstore sounds pretty good.
Amy Cortese, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A business, finance, and environmental journalist. She's also the author of Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It. She addressed the annual meeting of the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund this week, and there are more links to more on that fund to Amy's blog and to her recently published op-ed in the New York Times. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. And of course, you can always invest your thoughts and ideas in our locally produced program on Facebook and Twitter. When we come back, pushing back against America's supersized tendencies, we're going to hear about living with little from an advocate of the tiny house movement. It's after a short break. This is Word of Mouth on NHPR. Wherever you choose to invest your cash, you may want to start small, especially if looking to sink some money into the anemic housing market. Stories of people foreclosing after buying too much house and of lenders encouraging more profitable loans for ginormous McMansion-y houses are fodder for the tiny house movement. People who live in houses so small, they're illegal in some places. KALW's John Atkinson visits one of the movement's great advocates, helping Bay Area residents scale down to teeny quarters.
Walt Whitman wrote that a man is not a whole and complete man unless he owns a house and the ground it stands on. I'm thinking of those words as I pull up in Grayton for a tour of Jay Schaefer's latest tiny house. It's just 7 by 14 feet. So small, it violates current housing codes. That's one of the reasons it's mounted on a trailer bed. Housing regulations are really extensive, but trailer regulations are practically non-existent.
Stepping right inside the front door, to the left side, we've got the kitchen, which is very small, just about 4.5 or maybe 4 feet long. To the right side of the front door, there is the bathroom, which is probably the smallest full bath in the world, as far as I know, anyway.
Schaefer's a practice salesman. He's given Oprah Winfrey and Anderson Cooper similar tours. The New Yorker calls him the brainy misfit behind the tiny house trend, and he's definitely the closest thing the movement has to a celebrity.
Which is about 8 feet by 6.5 feet wide.
Schaefer often says there's something luxurious about living simply. It frees you up to do what you actually enjoy, since you're not constantly working to pay for a lot of stuff you can't afford.
It's really about buying less and living with less, living just with what you need to be happy rather than a bunch of extra stuff.
So there's a philosophical reason to go small. But for others,
It's more a pragmatic solution to economic and personal need than it is a change in lifestyle of now I don't want so much.
That's Stephen Marshall. He owns a business in Petaluma called Little House on the Trailer.
I get a fair amount of walk-in traffic because we're sitting here on the highway in a used car lot, so people notice and they stop, and everybody's sort of enchanted by the idea.
Marshall says that when many of these people come through, they talk about trying to use less or be green.
That's all the idealistic narrative around little houses. None of those people, not one of those people, out of, say, 30 houses that we've sold now, has been a buyer.
His clients are more practical. Many of them buy his houses for their elderly parents. That's where economics kicks in. On average, you'll pay about $2,500 a month to move your parents into an assisted living facility. But for around $6,000, Marshall will build you a little house, and you can park your parents in the backyard and take care of them yourself. Marshall's clients aren't worrying about saving the world. They want their immediate needs met at the best price.
Sort of reminiscent of a little ship's cabin, and I'll close the door, and it's nice and airtight and cozy and warm. And you look up here, we got a skylight.
Bill Glancing built a tiny house in his backyard in San Francisco's Bernal Heights neighborhood. One of his sons had moved home after graduating from UCLA. He kept sending out resumes but couldn't find a job. At the same time, Glancing's younger son also decided to move home from Davis.
And I was not about to say, well, you know, too bad you're old enough, you know, go out and get a job or something, because, you know, it really wasn't a viable solution. You know, I'm not going to turn my sons out in the street, but we needed more room.
Glancing's main house is already pretty small by many people's standards. It's 1,000 square feet. He built his backyard cabana himself for somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. It's an addition, a guest house. But others are actually moving full-time into smaller places.
Okay, picture this.
That's Brenda Daughtry. She and her partner, Cece Reinhardt, recently moved into an Airstream, one of those vaguely retro Silver Bullet-type trailers. To do so, they've had to downsize to meet strict limits. Their overall weight can't be more than 15,000 pounds.
We come back from being weighed. We bring in the scale. And we start putting stuff on the scale. Okay, that's 3 pounds of wool curtain that's coming out. Okay, write it down. That's an extra pair of scissors and a pot and a pan. That's 8 pounds. Take it out.
So we shaved 88 pounds in 2 hours, and we are very proud.
It's not a tiny house. They'd like one of those in a few years, maybe. But they're definitely engaging in some tiny living. The trailer is 25 feet long, 160 square feet.
I mean, it took us living in excess many years, kind of the California dream, what we thought we were supposed to have. We each had a car, you know, we had a big house. It took several years of that. And then looking at our bank account each month and our savings account each month and our Roth each month and our retirement each month and going, you know, this isn't exactly where we want to go.
Slowly, they started to downsize. They got rid of things they hadn't used in a year and sold their big house to rent a smaller place. They're debt-free now and have begun to save money.
I think it was a bit of a, you know, a kick to my ego to actually admit that I don't need all this stuff and this stuff isn't what you thought the stuff would bring you.
Talking to Reinhardt and Daughtry, it strikes me that their reasons for downsizing have a lot in common with Henry David Thoreau's. In the 1840s, he moved into his own tiny house, an experience he described in Walden, where he wrote that the cost of a thing is the amount of life which is required to be exchanged for it, immediately or in the long run. How does my stuff influence the life that I live? How much of my life will I spend paying for that stuff? And how do I actually feel about that? These are the questions tiny houses are asking. They're big ones, and have to do with the meaning of life itself. So it makes sense that, to answer them, these people have started by rethinking the places they live. For Cross Currents, I'm John Atkinson.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same.
Well, that's it for Word of Mouth today, produced today by a We production staff of two, with special thanks to Craig Martin, who drove the show. I'm going to get over my Yankee aversion to self-promotion and encourage you, for Guy Raz's sake, to come hear me interview him at the Tupelo Music Hall on Tuesday. Maybe you've heard Guy Raz filling in for All Things Considered host Michelle Norris these past few weeks. Maybe you've heard him talk with Bill Gates about innovation or with Mark Zuckerberg about being awkward on Weekend All Things Considered. Well, before he was a host, Guy Raz had a very impressive career as a foreign correspondent. He was named NPR's Wunderkind Berlin bureau chief at age 25, was later London bureau chief and Jerusalem correspondent for CNN, chronicling at the time Hamas's rise as a political power, and then Israel's 2005 withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. So he's reported from 40 countries, with distinction befitting a young man who was once an assistant to the late and the great Daniel Shore. So consider a trip to lovely White River Junction. It is a chance to catch a true bright light of journalism in his ascendancy. Details are online at the events page on nhpr.org. And join us for headlights from the program this Saturday at noon and again next week at noon and 9 p.m. and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by Virginia Prescott, Taylor Quimby, and Rebecca Lavoie. Oversight and support comes from Program Director Abby Goldstein and web support from Brady Carlson. We receive help from our online community of bloggers and contributors. Dan Colgan is our engineer. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. For more information about the show, to post a comment, or to listen to these interviews again and read our blog, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.